Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams, Scott Spears, along with you in the holiday spirit. On this Thursday, December 17th, 2020, 18 minutes past the hour, and we have got a great 2 hours for you. A matter of fact, if you want to know about the holidays, if you want to get in the holiday mood, spirit, and full of cheer, this is the program this morning. Now, tonight, I do want to remind people that we are having our holiday special, 7:10 to 9 p.m. live here tonight on this station, the annual WWGH Radio Holiday Special, tonight, 7:10 until 9 p.m. right here on this station. Coming up next hour, we are going to be joined by best-selling author and the queen, undisputed queen of helpful hints for more than a half century. She still writes a column in Good Housekeeping magazine, and she joins us once a month. And this morning, she'll be letting us know about those holiday get-togethers, although small this year, and tips for wrapping and scents in the house and decorating the tree if you haven't done that yet. Last-minute Christmas gifts that you can get online. The amazing Heloise will be along in hour number two this morning. Now, we have a real touchstone here in hour number one, because he's one of my favorite guests. He never lets me call him a legend, so I'm just going to say he's one of my favorite guests, and we'll go with that praise here this morning. You have watched him on television for the better part of a half century. He was with ABC News. He was a White House correspondent during the Nixon presidency, during the Clinton presidency. He was a regular on the David Brinkley Sunday Morning Show. Then he hosted the Sunday Morning Show with the late Cokie Roberts. The Primetime Live news magazine, which in its day was in the top 10 constantly, he was the co-anchor of that show with Diane Sawyer. What a pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones for a special holiday program. This is going to be kind of fun. Usually this guest and I get on and talk about the politics of the day, and we're going to do a little bit of that because during the pandemic and a presidential transition, it's hard not to do that. But we're going to talk about Christmases in Washington. We're going to talk about Christmases as a child and maybe have a couple holiday readings here. What a pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones the classic Sam Donaldson. Sam, happy holidays.
Hey, classic. I like that. Well, welcome to God's country, otherwise known as New Mexico. It's pitch black still here. It's that early in the morning. But the weather forecast says it's going to be sunny today in Chavez Canyon. Temperature 65 degrees, no snow here. And I'm delighted to be here rather than back east in the pandemic known as the snowstorm.
You know, it's funny, Sam. I was driving in this morning, and we did not have what would qualify as a storm. We had a couple inches on the ground yesterday, and it's white outside. It's a few days from Christmas. Is that more difficult in a warmer climate at this point for you to celebrate the holiday?
I don't think so. I mean, when I was growing up as a kid in New Mexico, Christmas was just one of those wonderful moments you look forward to. And yes, there were the gifts, but there was the Christmas tree and there was the food and all of that. And there was the celebration for Christians of Christ's time. And it was just the fact that we didn't have snow and a sleigh and the horses pulling the sleigh didn't matter at all.
Sam, this is always a big question, and I think about this a lot. We have the part of Christmas, which is Santa Claus and letter writing and Rudolph and all that, and then we have the religious part, the birth of the baby Jesus. Where do you think it comes down percentage-wise in 2020 celebration?
Well, Well, of course, everything changes. That's the constant of life. And so the celebrations that people have today are different. And there are perhaps more people who don't pay attention to Christmas as there was a century ago, or even less time than that here in the United States. But everyone does it in their own fashion. And of course, when I talked about the fact that it celebrates the birth of Christ, this is not just for Christians. Christmas has become, whether you use the name Christmas, Christ, right, or the celebration, for everybody of all faiths, it seems to me. And it is, as you pointed out early, so delighted. If we talk a little bit about politics, fine, but mainly, we're not going to talk about that as a sole part of the program. And I'm not going to get upset and you know, heated and all of that, because I love Christmas as much as anyone else does, I think, and I'm happy it's here. Although, this year, normally, I would be with, my wife, Sandy, we would be with our families, they'd be with us, or we'd come visit them. No one's here now, except Sandy, my wife, and we're very cognizant of the need to keep the pandemic away by doing all of the things that science tells us properly will help us keep the pandemic away from us till we get vaccinated. So, but it's not going to be Christmas. It's when I say it's lonely without our families, it's still good. It's still a good celebration. Someone once said, just mixing this sort of metaphor here. I interviewed Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court during his last couple of years. His good friend Bill Brennan had retired, and Marshall was the only liberal at that point on the court. And I asked him, is it going to be lonely? He says, no, no. He says, as long as I agree with myself, I'm fine. So as long as Sandy and I like Christmas and enjoy the holiday, we're not going to be sitting here moping and mordant and all of that. We're going to be happy.
That's a great line. That is a great line. Let's get the two questions, and there are only going to be two here this morning that have to do with things going on in the world, so let's knock those out before we get in the Christmas spirit here. And let's start with the pandemic. It is right now worrisome. Dr. Fauci is worried. He says that people are going to get together and celebrate for Christmas like they always do. He's begging them to have a scaled-back Christmas. What do you think is going to happen here in the next week or so?
About the pandemic and about how people gather?
Yeah.
Well, we saw what happened at Thanksgiving. By that time, the latest surge, and it is the biggest surge, and it is killing more people per day in the United States and worldwide, is of course, just huge. But people are people. They could disregard it. Some of them say, well, it's not serious. They still say it's a hoax. Oh, it's a political hoax by the Democrats or something. Some of them simply say, hey, I'm big and strong. Not that many people die. If you look at the percentages of the people who are infected and versus the percentages of those who die who are infected, it's very small. Won't be me. I mean, all of those things that people would say, okay, I hope they get it through, but many of them will die. And many of them will get together just maybe with their families. That's fine, except if one of the members of their family happens to be asymptomatic, not meaning to infect his love or her loved ones, but does, and pop and mam or grandfather dies, is it worth it? I don't think so. I mean, this argument over should we open up and get business back, because people are out of work and people need help, and the Congress appears to be moving at last to try to bring some more aid to people that are, you say, down on your luck. They're not down on their luck. They were in the sense that they did anything wrong. The pandemic has gotten us all. So if you have the argument, should we open up and get people back to work, even though some of them will die? All right. No. I'm for Fauci. I'm for science, and I'm for people who say, let's try to all be as safe as possible while we help people who are in economic straits and need that help now. Because we see light at the end of the tunnel. We see these vaccines. I say to Sandy, we'd like to see our family. We'd like to see some of our friends. We'd like to do all of those things. But we've made it through. Now, I'll be 87 in March, and she's a little younger, but in her 70s. We've made it through so far. Why blow it at the end? We see the vaccines coming. and they are effective, and they work, and they will save lives. So why go out now and have a good time? It may be your last.
Here's my only follow-up to that, because I found something interesting earlier on this week. Our governor here, Mike DeWine, who has been pretty well applauded during this whole pandemic.
By me, not in Ohio, and I've known him since he was in the Senate, and I agree, he's done the right thing for Ohio.
He did make a quote, though, earlier this week that landed in all the papers that I thought was interesting. When the vaccines were being distributed for the first time down at OSU Hospital down here, he made a quote, or said a quote that was quoted in a lot of papers, that this is the beginning of the end of this. Is that the right thing to say right now?
Well, I think it is, because obviously he's trying to be cautious. People say, well, wait a moment, maybe I'm in a group that's going to be vaccinated in March. Or maybe even February, and then I can just, now let's go to the Virgin Islands. Okay, right. No, because as long as we don't have so-called herd immunity, as long as we don't get to the point where we are stronger than the virus and it has to go home, and it has to go in the ground and stop this nonsense, it's better to be vigilant than to open up too soon. You saw what happened last May. We opened up so many places and in June too soon, and people died, and the virus came back, and it wasn't killed at all. It came back to kill us. So I'm for people like Governor DeWine. Yes, it's right to say we see, you know, the old phrase, light at the end of the tunnel, and this tunnel isn't as long as it used to be, so it's coming. It's coming. But until we get there, keep the mask on, and maybe after that for other reasons. Don't socialize to the extent that you don't have the social distance necessary. Wash your hands and all of that stuff. And we just have to keep doing that.
And the only political question, and I'm going to lump a whole lot of stuff into one question here. The Electoral College voted on Monday. Joe Biden will be our next president. President Trump has not conceded. Attorney General Barr is leaving before Christmas. How do you see the next month playing out?
Well, in the next month, perhaps, is the most dangerous time. Joe Biden won the election, 49 of 50 court suits went against all the Trump efforts and efforts by Trumpsters to overturn the will of the people. The Electoral College has spoken. It's counted the votes. Yes, it will take it under the procedure to Congress in early January. And there is a procedure that if a member of the House and a member of the Senate object to it, they'll have to vote on it. But that vote clearly will come down on the side of Joe Biden and the Democrats. I mean, that's just, unless the creek rises to the extent, as the old saying goes, we've never seen. So when we see people continue to reject, well, they're rejecting the results of the election just as some of them reject science, reject facts, reject truth. It's dangerous because there are angry people out there. There are people who have been, in my view, misled into believing that the election is rigged. It was all stolen. Never mind three counts in Georgia. No, that's all wrong. By Republicans, the governor Republican, the secretary of state Republican, the people who do the counting with oversight by Democrats, Republican. And people still say, no, it's a fraud. I feel sorry for those people in one extent, because we've got to do something. I say we've got to do something with and for the Americans who have been misled. I'm not, by being misled, you know, I'm not saying that they're not entitled to their views of whether we should have taxation or not, to what extent, or all the public things. But they've been misled into believing something that is false, and it's dangerous. We've seen some violence so far, but I think January will be the last. The president yesterday, apparently, according to news reports, raged in the White House. One of his aides is reported to have said he was having a meltdown, saying, I'm not leaving, I'm going to stay. No, you're not going to stay. You're going to leave. And if you think you're going to stay, the spectacle of a president of the United States being dragged out by federal marshals is something I don't want to see. Mm. And I don't think Americans ought to want to see either. So he's leaving. And after that, it's not, okay, now we're all over, and now we're going to be friends. No, that's not true. So that's why I think we have to continue to figure out what to do with people who reject Joe Biden's presidency. And by rejected, of course, have a right to vote against it if he runs again, of course. But I'm talking about will not cooperate in the American system, will not cooperate in trying to get things done across the aisle for all Americans. We have to do something with them in the sense that they cannot prevail, and we must not allow them to prevail. But at the same time, for them, what are their legitimate grievances? Why have they felt left out? Why have they felt that they've got to stick it in the eye of those people who have been controlling them all this time? That is something that we need to work on, those of us fortunate enough not to be in that group, because they are Americans. They are citizens. They have a right to live and to prosper in this country anymore, just as you and I do and everybody else. So I don't reject them in any way except to say, no, you cannot continue to do things which are inimical to democracy and the American system. We're not going to allow that.
And my only follow-up to this is, because I think history is important, and when you're in it, you're living it now, and you really don't have much of a perspective on it. When history looks back on this, when we're all gone in 100 years, and all the players are gone in 100 years who were involved, because it had not happened before, how is this six-week and plus period in which there was no concession, there was no acceptance of a loss, there may be a president who doesn't attend the inauguration of the next president. What, all the lawsuits, how does history look at this period?
Well, we don't know, you're quite right, but I would hope that, and I do expect, and I hope, that history will see it as one of those terrible anomalies in the American experience that started at Valley Forge, and it started with our Constitution, it started back then, when the founding fathers, many of them slaveholders, yes, tried to get this union into a perfect picture of a democratic system. And there were these anomalies. I guess the Civil War so far, in my mind, ranks as the biggest one so far, the most dangerous one at that time in the period and since. We fought wars, Second World War, dangerous to the country. But we were going to prevail. We had the might. Not just the military might, we had the might of a united country with great resources. If you want to build another aircraft carrier, no one said, we can't afford that. Oh, what do you mean? No, spend the money. And then, of course, later pay for it after the war. So those things came along, too. And Vietnam, in my experience as a correspondent, I'd served my 2.5 years on active duty in Army artillery, but we had a president there named Eisenhower. I like to say, admiringly, too dumb to get us into a war, so I didn't fight the war, but I covered the war in Vietnam. And all of the experiences since, Cuban Missile Crisis, I won't take off our time adding them up. I think this, to me, ranks as the second to the Civil War dangerous period for American democracy, which means our country. Yes, the country would still be here if we had autocratic rule, if we had a dictator, and our system changed. But we wouldn't have what we have. This wouldn't be the land of opportunity. This wouldn't be the land where you can prosper if you work hard. This wouldn't be the land that we value. And when it comes to Christmas and that kind of holiday, it would be a hollow holiday to me in a land with a dictator and a government which suppresses the people instead of acts according to the people's will. So I think we're in a dangerous period, but I believe we're going to get through it. I think we're going to cure next year not only the pandemic, but we're going to make important strides, won't finish, in having the country come together again, for the most part, and people who need our help, who have been misled, kind of saying, well, okay, I didn't like it at first, but it's a pretty good country, and I think we can get together.
And to switch gears now, we are going to go into the holiday mood. Now, Sam, you say you love Christmas. What is it about Christmas for you that is special?
Well, you know, you said we could do some readings, and maybe you've got other people scheduled. But the answer to that question comes from the editorial in The Sun in New York in 1897. This little girl, Virginia O'Hanlon, had asked her father, is it really a Santa Claus? And he was a coroner in New York, and he said, well, write to The Sun newspaper. Maybe they can tell you. And she did. And a guy named Francis Church, who was one of the editors, had been a war correspondent in the Civil War, wrote a beautiful piece explaining to Virginia that there, yes, there is a Santa Claus. And in that piece, if we have time to read it, and maybe others will read it too, is the answer to your question. What is it about Christmas? And it's directed toward an 8-year-old child. But if you read the whole piece, every one of us, I don't care how old you are, can respond to what the church wrote.
Sam, let's read that right now, because I think people need to hear that.
Well, it's fairly lengthy, but I'll try to be, I'll not try to ad-lib my own view. As I say, Francis Church wrote it in reply to a letter from little Virginia O'Hanlon. And here is what he wrote. Virginia, your little friends are wrong, because she had said, you know, some of them were telling me no Santa Claus. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant, in his intellect, as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole of truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist. And you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there were no Santa Claus. It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The eternal light with which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. Not believe in Santa Claus? You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch in all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not. But that's no proof that they are not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders that are unseen and unseeable in the world. You may tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside. But there is a veil covering the unseen world which not the strongest man, or even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture this supernal beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in all this world, there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus. Thank God, he lives, and he lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia, nay, 10 times 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood. Mm. That's what Francis Church wrote, and it's beautiful. I was very privileged, Scott. In 1993, John Williams, the great composer, the movie composer, Jaws, Star Wars, Superman, artificial intelligence, all those great things, was leaving his time conducting the Boston Pops, that great organization that the original conductor, Arthur Fiedler, had begun so many years previous. In 1993, he was then going to conduct his last Christmas hour, maybe it was even 90 minutes, I've forgotten. And he called me, the reporter in Washington, and said, would you like to come and read Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus? Well, I said, I think I would. Yes, please. And so I did. And it was just one of the great moments for me at Christmas time to be able to do that.
You know, Sam, I look at that. It's over 100 years old at this point. I believe it's the most read editorial in the history of history.
You're right.
Why do you think it? Nothing has touched it since? It holds up so well. What is it about the letter itself?
Well, it holds up so well, in my view, because all of us, no matter how cynical we get, no matter how downhearted we get about the world around us, no matter how we want to sit sometimes and say, you know, life is unfair to me and all of that, all of us yearn for beauty. We learn for those words that Francis Church wrote. We long for romance and love and poetry. We long for good things. I think, I don't know the most, if you could point out the most cynical American who rejects everything that I've been talking about, I think deep down in that person's soul or being or heart, and you can put any name to a person you want to that at the moment might be seen in that category, I think there still is some spark, some ember of wanting exactly what Francis Church wrote. That's why it's held up. It speaks to everyone. It speaks to little Virginia, who lived to 1971, as a matter of fact. But it speaks to every one of us.
You know, and the postscript to that, which I did not realize until the other day, Virginia O'Hanlon, the little girl who wrote that letter, as you say, lived to 1971. I believe she was 81 years old when she died. One of the last Christmases, she was alive. She was in a nursing home, and Santa Claus came to visit her. And there's a picture of her 81 years old with Santa Claus, and the look on her face, you couldn't paint a better picture.
I didn't know that, and it's one of those little factoids I'll try to remember because I think it's also beautiful. The look on her face, I mean, I don't know what it reflected. It reflected joy at hearing the reading of the editorial. It was written in an editorial in The Sun when she read it then. But I think, again, we come back to this theme that you and I have been talking about, that in everyone's heart there is Christmas. And I'm now not talking just about the religious side of Christmas. That is what Church, the editorialist, wrote. Everyone has this. And sometimes we forget it, and sometimes we don't act like we even remember that it exists because we do bad things, mean things, selfish things, and all of that. But it comes back to it. I think, call me Pollyanna, I think people want to be good people, in the sense of good neighbors, look on the bright side when they can. I mean, if at the moment you're out of work, you're about to be evicted, if Congress doesn't act and all that, hard to look on the bright side. But in the long run, look on it that way, I think you'll have a happier life. At least it's worked out so far for me.
You know, Sam, I've thought about this a lot this year. Of course, we don't want to forget the true meaning of Christmas, the religious meaning of it, but here in the Midwest, it's a dark time of year. We lose daylight hours right through December 21st. When I'm driving here in the morning, and it's still dark outside, it's nice to see the colored lights that have been left on the night before. It's nice to see Christmas trees in people's windows. Is it so bad to have that stuff? Because sometimes it is frowned upon. It's called commercial and the wrong side of Christmas.
Well, I don't think it's bad to have a Christmas tree. I don't think it's bad to put up tinsel and lighting if you can. And not only for yourself, we have a house in Albuquerque as well as here in Chavez Canyon, where I am at the moment. Last year, we had a Christmas party. We loved to have the Christmas party. And a lot of people came and we served booze and eggnog and talked and what have you. But this year, no one's coming because we don't have a party. No one's going to come, even if we were dumb enough to invite, 50 people or 25 people or even 100 people. But we have a Christmas tree, and we have lights on it and the tinsel and all of that. And we have a window that looks out over the street below our house, and people... Pardon me, people in the neighborhood see the tree. And we've had a couple of calls, you know, people saying, thank you for putting up a tree. We We didn't have one this year because of what Scott, you just said. It's commercial, and we don't have any children, so why not dispense with it? But they still wanted to see our tree because, again, I come back to this theme of mine. In their heart, they thought about the holiday, no matter what their faith, their religious faith, or lack of it, and it meant something.
And also, not to forget, because here in the Midwest, again, the temperatures do get cold this time of year, you can drive by a lot of churches, and you will see the live manger scene with live people out there at certain times of the day in this very cold weather. And it happens every year, and it's also great to see that live people in that manger scene this time of year.
Yeah, well, that's true. I'm coughing a little now, but it's not the pandemic. I don't have... don't have the virus. But poor Joe Biden. Remember the other night he came out to give a speech? And poor guy coughed all through the speech. It's one of those things. You, as a communicator, understand this. I'm sure you, even though you're much younger than I am, you have some times when you're on the radio and you're talking and all of a sudden you get a seizure, something's in your throat. Well, I'll get it out. So once in a while I'll leave you putting my hand over the transmitter part of the phone, and you continue asking me the question. If I come back, don't answer the questions because I didn't hear it.
You know, Sam, it's a very interesting thing. The other day, I forget who I was having the conversation with, but we were talking about radio versus television and other forms of communication. And the thing about radio is, even though we do have these moments because we're live and people cough and people sneeze and people do whatever they do, maybe say the wrong word or pronounce the wrong word, there's something very... We would not get this much time on television. Radio is still very personable, I think.
It's the most personable form of communication, other than you're standing in a room with someone and looking at the face and talking to them, because of the old business about people can make up what they can't see in their minds. For instance, I've never met you, and I'd be ashamed to say I have never seen a picture of you. I have in my mind what you look like. I could be dead wrong, but I've made up a picture on your voice, and to some extent, I guess, on what you say, of what you look like. I'll give you an example. Yesterday, I was listening on Bloomberg Radio to the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, but he likes to go by Jay Powell. The Open Market Committee had met, had made no change as far as the discount rate is concerned. He continued, and the committee continued to pledge it would do what was necessary to keep this economy running. It would buy as much paper as would exist in the world to do that if it needed to. Now, what does he look like? Well, if you look at Jay Powell, I don't have his biography in front of me, but he's at least in his 50s, could be in his 60s. He looks not like an old man, but he looks like a man who's approaching an elderly age. You listen to him, he looks like you, because I think you're a young man, see? You just listen to his voice, you're thinking you're talking to a kid here, maybe he's 40. So we make this up when we use radio and when we hear things in radio. One of the great documentaries, in a sense, that I listened to when I was young, was called On the Verge of Triumph of Norman Corwin, right after World War II in Europe ended, after the peace treaty was signed in Europe, and it was a great radio, I'm sure you've seen it, or you've heard it, and you weren't there, and you didn't see the war as you saw it, if you saw film and all that, but you heard it. You heard it in the voice of the narrator, Martin Balsam, I think it was. In any event, that's what radio does, and television can't do it. It can show you the pictures that radio can't immediately, and you see it, and it's vivid, and it moves people one way or the other. But radio moves them even farther, because we, in our minds, can see things that maybe weren't there, but we imagine them.
That's absolutely true. We've got about 10 minutes left with Sam this morning, and I believe we have one more Christmas reading we're going to do. We'll save that for the very end, and it's the most read, I think, Christmas poem or Christmas-themed anything in the history of Christmas, probably. But before we do that, Sam spent a lot of Christmas times, Christmas seasons, in Washington, D.C., and maybe second to New York City. Washington, D.C. is a destination for a lot of people. They light the big tree. It's the White House tours of Christmas. It's all decorated. Sam, what's Christmas in D.C. like?
Well, in normal times, it's, as you explained, people come to the Capitol. If they've never been there, they're in awe of it, and they should be in awe of it. The lighting of the National Christmas Tree, of course, is a ceremony that people watch on television or hear on the radio if they want. And in the old days, before all of the fences went up, before Pennsylvania Avenue that runs in front of the White House was open to traffic and people walked in the sidewalk just by the fence. And, of course, the tree is lighted in the back. It's a great... Every great national undertaking centers eventually on Washington, and not just the political. It is the capital of our country. It is the symbol of the Washington Monument of who we are. And so Christmas is no exception. This year, of course, I'm not there. I don't want to be there. And it's dreary, and we just saw recently, the last few days, the great turmoil in the streets, the fighting and all of that because of the business of the election and then how we're divided as a country. But again, I believe that we'll get over that, and I believe we'll cure that. But it'll take some time, and Washington can resume to be a good place at Christmas.
Sam, did you ever attend one of those great White House Christmas parties?
Well, I'll tell you a story. Sometimes I was invited to parties. I don't remember a Christmas party that their president invited me to. The press is invited to parties right at Christmas. I just don't recall that. But I do recall a moment when the lighting of the Christmas tree I almost participated in. There is a time they have people dress up as Santa Claus. I guess that's it. And they have people that they think are well-known or celebrities or what have you. And the committee called me during the Clinton administration and said, we'd like you to dress up as Santa Claus. And I said, oh, that's terrific. You know, in my day, you asked me to come to the corner and preen, I would do it, I suppose. But in any event, then they had to call me back and say, well, and then she said to me, well, the Clintons will be delighted that you've agreed. They had to call me back and say, we had a change of plans, and they didn't say why, but I understood, because it was a time when President Clinton, I was White House correspondent, I think we were all after him because of the Monica Lewinsky case, and while he conducted himself the best way he could, certainly there was no scenes in which he denounced reporters when they ask a pesky question about Lewinsky to their face, said they should be fired and all of this. But I think he was not happy with us, and I think he was not happy with me, and I understood, and I bear him no ill will.
Now that's an interesting story.
Santa Claus.
That's a good story. That's a good behind-the-scenes Christmas story.
It has the added benefit of being true.
That is something. Ticked off at Christmas and a little change in Santa Clauses. Well, Sam, we've got this other reading. Now, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas has been around forever, and nothing ever surpasses it as far as readings go. It's done on radio, it's done on television, done everywhere. What is it about that poem, I think is what it's referred to as, that holds up so well?
Well, it's for everybody. Again, children, mainly children, Santa Claus and all of that. But, you know, that's the night before Christmas also have some of that. And Mom and we were with our kerchiefs and cap, we were just laying down for you read it, but long litter's nap. In other words, adults are part of it, too. And the thought of Santa Claus coming down that chimney and his little round belly and smoke. And I love the end, you know, up the chimney sprang the sleigh with a whistle, and off they flew, Donder, and all of those people. and it ends with happy Christmas. Not Merry Christmas, but Happy Christmas.
Well, Sam, if you would like to give us that, we would love to hear it.
I don't have it. I prepared by writing out, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. You read it. You have it.
I do. You know what? I will do that in just a second. But let's... Santa. I both called you Santa, Sam.
I'll get to be Santa eventually.
You will. You'll get there eventually. What were Christmases like when you were a child?
I lived on a farm below Las Cruces, New Mexico, near the line with Texas. Occasionally, once in a while, there'd be some snow in the ground, but not much. It doesn't snow a lot in New Mexico, except in the north. And I looked forward as I grew up, you know, 4, 5, 6 to Christmas. And I believed in Santa Claus until a point when you have to read Church's poem to Virginia as to talking about Santa Claus. I lived with my mother. My father was deceased. He had a heart attack, in fact, before I was born, his last heart attack. In those days, if you had heart trouble that today people can have bypass surgery, they can have their aortic valve, as I have, replaced. I mean, no problem. But then you put glycerin under your tongue, and it would thin the blood a little bit, so when you had the blocked arteries, and a little bit more I got through. So I was conceived, and then in a few weeks he died. So my mother was Christmas. We're just the two of us. And she, since we lived on the farm, we had plenty of food. I didn't know the kind of deprivation during the Great Depression that so many people did. We had sustained life. Thanks to Franklin Roosevelt, we had electricity. When I was actually born, we didn't quite have it, but we the rural electrification got in there. So we had all the necessities of life. But we didn't have a lot, so I didn't have a whole multitude of gifts right away in all of this. The one thing I remember was Lincoln Logs. Lincoln Logs was a game, not a game. It was a set of logs that you constructed a little Lincoln house, or you constructed things with the logs. And I just remember that more than anything else for Christmas gifts early on. Mm.
Sam, do you have a favorite Christmas song, all these songs we hear at Christmas time?
Oh, you know, dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh, over the hills we go, laughing all the way. Everyone likes Jingle Bells. You know, so I like that song, and there are others. Bing Crosby singing White Christmas. At the time during that movie, it wasn't coming. It was kind of an afterthought. The movie was sort of an afterthought, and all of a sudden, as the years went by, White Christmas, Irving Berlin's great song, was another one, and Bing Crosby will always be associated with it. So to ask me. Pick out one favorite song. I guess in one sense it's Jingle Bells, another sense it's White Christmas. And there are hymns, religious hymns, that of course always are at Christmas time. And the great music, Handel's great music, the Requiem. Listen to the Christmas music. It's not all Jingle Bells. It speaks of the majesty of the moment, and the moment lives for the ages.
Sam, just leave our audience here before we part ways, and I will read 'Twas the Night Before Christmas before the audience as the morning goes on, but leave the audience with a Christmas message.
Well, I've the theme that I've, through the thread of our discussion today, is it may be a lonely Christmas for some because of the need to stay apart, and it may be a bad Christmas for others because of the need to have something to eat. We have bread lines. We have soup kitchens in this country like we've never seen since the Great Depression. People are hungry. So my theme would be, let's get through this. Let's help each other get through this. Not just the Congress, which looks like it may put some more money up on the table immediately. I hope so this week, maybe today. Let's get through this. We will get through it as a country. I have absolute faith. It's going to be difficult, as I say, and I won't go over the old ground, but we will return to our principles in this country, our norms in this country, and it will be a good country. I have absolute belief in that. So at this Christmas time, let's not despair, even though at the moment there are reasons for us to despair. Let's look to the future, because I think the future is going to be bright again for the United States of America.
Sam, it's been great to have you on during the holiday time. I can't thank you enough. I hope you and Mrs. Donaldson have a great holiday and a happy new year, and thank you for everything this past year.
I appreciate being with you, Scott. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. The legendary Sam Donaldson. We're coming back with Heloise in about 15 minutes.